Today's program was brought to you by Roth Cheese, a pioneer in the U.S. specialty cheese movement. For more information, visit rothcheese.com. This week on Meat and Three, we're exploring the intersection between food, agriculture, and competition. Learn how a chicken raising contest in the 1940s led to the poultry industry we have today.
And they were going to run a contest and try and develop what they would call the chicken of tomorrow.
We'll also venture into the world of agricultural video games, where a new set of tractors is making a lot of fans happy.
The biggest addition to 19 was the John Deere's. That's what everyone was hyped for.
And we pay a visit to a group of Indian restaurants that aren't on the friendliest of terms.
Usually they wait for my restaurant, but after a long wait, they go to next door or downstairs. But this is how they do business. They completely copy whatever we do.
Embrace your competitive spirit and be the first to listen to new Meat and Three episodes by subscribing now. That's Meat plus sign THREE, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to Food Without Borders, a show about food, politics, and identity. I'm your host, Sari Kamen, and you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Today, I'm in studio with Fatima Khawaja. Raised in Lahore, Pakistan, Fatima moved to the United States for college and received a scholarship to study at the Culinary Institute of America in San Antonio. She has cooked in a wide range of restaurants, including Bouchon Bakery, Cosme, and Demaria in New York. She now works as a private chef and is rediscovering the cuisine of her native Pakistan. Welcome to the show, Fatima.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for being here. Well, let's just dive right in. So were you born in Pakistan or somewhere else?
So I was born in the Middle East. I was born in the UAE in Abu Dhabi. My parents were out there for like 15 years.
What were they doing there?
So my dad was banking. And my mom was raising a family. Yeah. I'm the youngest of four. And my dad ended up leaving banking and entering politics in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. And so we moved back when I was just one. And then I was raised in Pakistan.
So I'm sure you have no memory of what
Zero.
It was like.
I mean, my siblings do. And, of course, my parents feel like it was still pretty recent. When they go back, it's all very familiar to them. But for me, it's Pakistan is all I know.
Yeah. What was your life like in Pakistan?
For me, I felt like it was really simple. I do know that I represent a pretty small percentage of Pakistan, had access to some of the best education. I led a pretty sheltered life. Went to an all-girls private school there and studied food there and just kind of, you know, grew up a kind of a regular life that I feel like the people that I grew up with had.
I thought families. It was interesting that you said you studied food and nutrition.
Yeah.
Was that in high school?
So that was in high school. So the education that I had, like I mentioned before, was British. And they offer different courses and different classes that you can take. And one of them was food nutrition that you had to take before ninth grade. And then when you enter ninth grade, you can kind of choose your own subjects. And it chose that. I guess it kind of had struck a chord with me. And then I ended up taking it for 3 years and took my Cambridge board exams in food nutrition. That was one of the subjects. I took it super seriously.
I mean, that's so interesting because I went to school. I did my master's studying food studies here. Mm-hmm. And that was a few years ago. And I feel like even now when I tell people I did that, they're like, that's a degree? Like, people do that?
Right.
And I think only now, like, you know, even with food on television and all the different shows, there's such like an awareness and
right.
interest in food that there wasn't even like 10 years ago.
Totally. I mean, I always say when I entered the food world and when I was studying food, when I was, you know, 16, 14, 15 years old, food was not like trendy. Food
right.
was not like cool. I was doing it because I loved it and because I felt like I was good at it and it had sparked a passion and I was interested in it. And so I kept pursuing it. And then
how did you know at such a young age that food was something that you could be interested in beyond like I'm hungry right now. Like, right. Let me put this in my mouth.
So it's actually kind of funny. My cousin, I have a lot of family in the States. And one of my cousins who was born in Chicago and raised, sorry, born in Singapore and raised in Singapore, but lived quite some time in Chicago in her adult life, ended up going to Johnston in Wales in Rhode Island and did her baking and pastry there. And that was kind of my first, experience, like, knowing that you could study this professionally and this could be something bigger than I'm just hungry and I know how to cook. So when the time came for me to apply for colleges, my dad asked me what I wanted to do. And I was like, I wonder if I can keep pursuing food somehow. And he was super, super supportive, which was unusual at the time, yeah. You know, to go down such a non-traditional path. And I applied to culinary schools, and I applied to culinary schools all over the U.S., and my first choice was the Culinary Institute of America in New York, and that was one of the last colleges I heard from, and I got in. And the rest is kind of history, and it's crazy. I never thought of doing anything else. So I think from just a young time, like, knowing that this could become something more, I just kept kind of pushing at it.
Did your parents cook?
My mother does. My mother's an excellent cook. With no professional training, like, she's probably better than me. She's so, so good. And I grew up with her cooking and her baking.
What are some of the dishes that you remember eating when you were growing up?
One dish that I actually wrote my college, like, application essay on was something called kadhai chicken, which was, like, a tomato... It's basically like a very kind of gravy-ish, not so loose chicken stew, but it's very quickly kind of almost stir-fried. It's not a stew. It's kind of stir-fried, and then it's served with rice. And my mom just made it really different. And I just remember coming back from school, and that was some of the most common things. That was one of the most common things that she would make for us. And I just remember coming back from school and, like, smelling that, knowing that that's what she made. And it was like a sensory memory for me. And I've always tried to recreate it, but I don't think anyone can make it as well as she does.
When you came to the U.S. for school, I know you had a British education when you were in Pakistan, but what was the experience like of coming to the United States and, you know, experiencing a totally different way of life here?
I think it was big time culture shock being here by myself.
Especially, you were in Texas, right?
So I moved to New York. And I was in New York for 3 years. And then I moved to Texas after I graduated from my bachelor's. And then I moved to Texas, to San Antonio, for a year after that. But I moved to New York, and I had visited a few times. But by a few, I mean, like, maybe 3 times in my whole life. And then all of a sudden, I was packing everything up and moving here when I was 18. And I just remember my parents dropping me off and saying goodbye to them in the parking lot, and when they drove away, it was like, dun dun dun.
It's
like,
real.
Like, did I really do this to myself? Like, no take backsies now. Like, this is happening.
Yeah, because they were going back to Pakistan.
Yeah, it was like, oh, maybe we'll see you next weekend if you're not too busy with, like, school stuff. But otherwise, you know, see you in Pakistan in a few months, because I was gonna visit home. And it was really surreal. I feel like I kind of acclimated pretty quickly, and I feel like I'm lucky that way. I made some really great friends who really kind of educated me on, like, American culture and American society, and, like, what is acceptable, what is not, like, what is the norm, like, things like that. I think that I couldn't have done it if I wasn't, you know, good at making friends or, you know, kind of friendly.
Yeah. What did you eat when you came here? Were you ever, like, craving Pakistani food, and was there ever anywhere to go?
So actually, my elder sister was already living in New York. She was married. She lived on the Upper West Side. And so that was my haven. That was, like, my home away from home. You know, going to see her over the weekends and getting, like, my Pakistani dose, my visit that I needed to kind of reconnect. So she kind of prevented a lot of homesickness and a lot of, like, missing that food. But, I mean, in college, I was in culinary school, so I can't complain about the things that I ate. And a lot of people that I was friends with were just fantastic cooks right out of the gate. And so making fresh pasta at my friend's house and making, you know, roast chickens and making turkey when we were 19 years old, like for Thanksgiving, just really, really excellent meals. And even at school, all the kitchens and all the food is done by the students. And so you can kind of walk into any of the classes and have whichever cuisine you want. And I mean, I talk about, especially I remember when I was in college and talked to my other friends from Pakistan who were also studying in the States and telling them what I was eating in comparison to what my friends were eating. And I knew I had it really well.
Yeah, I mean, most college students are eating like ramen, you know, out of a paper cup.
And I did that for sure. I did that too for like late night kind of thing. But I mean, my regular like cafeteria meals were really, really like high end.
Mine were not.
Yeah. I don't envy you.
And I was a vegan in college
too. Oh, really?
I don't know what I was doing.
Right.
So tell us about how you started to work in restaurants and what kind of places you found yourself.
So, let's see. So coming out of CIA, I wasn't really sure. When I graduated from New York, I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. And I actually have a very close friend who like convinced me to move to Texas with her to take the scholarship and go study Latin American food. So we moved out there together. And
oh, so you spent a year to kind of immersed in Latin American food?
Yeah. So the San Antonio campus is considered kind of like a Latin American campus. Oh. Because it's in San Antonio and a lot of people kind of, a lot of like the programs are focused around that. Less now, I think more when I was there, because the program that I did doesn't even exist anymore in San Antonio. But I moved out there, and then when I finished that, I moved back to Pakistan for a few months, and I actually was going to just settle in Pakistan. I had an interview with Unilever, which is like a big corporate company, and I was going to go work for them, and then I ended up moving back to the U.S., and my first kind of like big job was Bouchon. And I think I took Bouchon because it was Thomas Keller and because it was walking distance.
Both great reasons.
Yeah. And that was like kind of my first real difficult like job. I had worked at Union Square Cafe when I was a student at CIA, but I was a student. It was only for a few months. I mean, that was a big culture shock. If you're going to talk about culture shock, that was like being 19 and for the first time working in an American restaurant. It was very eye-opening. And then joining Bouchon, it was completely different because it was, you know, what it was. It was French. It was very, very high-end and very, very high standards and super, super fancy. And so working there was really, really tough. It was incredibly long hours and early mornings and barely any breaks. And it was kind of something I had to do to figure out what I didn't want to do. And then I left Bouchon.
It's kind of like dating.
Yeah, I guess so. Kind of is. And so like working with Bouchon was fantastic. I think I learned a lot of really, really good skills and habits from there that I still have. And then after that, I actually became a cheesemonger, which was so random, but so kind of necessary because I feel like when you enter into restaurants, it's like one restaurant after another. And then it's kind of nice to realize that there's something else you can do in the food industry that's not restaurants. Mm-hmm. So I worked as a cheesemonger, but I was actually waiting for Cosme to open. I'd been recruited by a friend who helped open Cosme, and I was basically waiting for it to open, and the date had keep getting pushed back. So I was working in Chelsea Market as a cheesemonger, and then I ended up at Cosme, and I was there at Cosme for a while. I think that was a really formative time where I was old enough to kind of be the cook that I wanted to be and kind of rise the ranks and make excellent food and be proud of where I was working. And
Food at Cosme, I mean, for anyone who hasn't been there, it's one of the best Mexican restaurants in the United States.
Absolutely.
I mean, it has a sister restaurant called Atla, and every time I go to either of them, I am blown away by the creativity, the flavors. I mean, it's just like a cerebral experience every time you eat there.
I think that it's one of the best restaurants in the U.S. Like, I think that it's Mexican and it's doing something that's unique to that. Mm-hmm. But also just aside from that. Because if you just look at that area that Cosme is in and you look at all those fantastic restaurants there, like, Cosme is up there with all of those restaurants. And even now when I meet people and they're like, oh, you've worked at Cosme, or someone will introduce me as, like, she used to work there, and I ask them if they've been and they haven't, I'm like, you must go. It's one of the...
Yeah, if you haven't been, you need to go. I mean, I go to Atlamore because it's a bit more affordable.
Right,
it's
quite a bit more affordable.
But it's absolutely one of my favorite restaurants that I've ever been to.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And I try to go there, you know, any opportunity to go.
Yeah.
I'm there.
It's just so good. And so I was there and I was super, super proud of being there. And I'm still proud that I was there because I helped open it. And so I feel like I'm still very invested in the success of these restaurants and the ones that are coming up and the ones that have opened after Cosme. And then after Cosme, I did a couple of, I was trying to find my way after that, and I ended up at De Maria, which brought me to my path kind of changed in the food that I was doing. And I met Camille Becerra, who's become a friend and who's become, you know, someone so different than what I'd been doing before. And I'm still working with her, and I was her sous chef at De Maria, and it just kind of helped me grow and kind of round out and figure out what kind of food I wanted to do for myself and what my identity is, which I think I'm still figuring out. But it was a really good place to kind of end my restaurant experiences.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about what you just said. I mean, you are doing your own thing now, which mm-hmm. means you're doing more working as a private chef and doing more events. But I mean, you also mentioned to me when we were initially talking about this, that you are connecting more with what it means for you to be Pakistani and that identity and that part of who you are and where you've come from and how you're able to connect with that through the food you're cooking.
Absolutely.
How are you reconnecting with your Pakistani identity through, you know, now that you're on your own and you're not restricted to like working in any restaurant and you can really play and like have the freedom to do whatever you want in the kitchen?
So, I was telling you before, I still don't think that I am 100% comfortable with Pakistani food. It's not something I studied, and it's not something I cooked when I was younger, and so I'm now starting to learn it, whether that be from my aunts, whether that be from a friend, whether that be from my sisters, whether that be from my mother, whether that be from online, and I'm just starting to teach myself and learn from other people and getting familiar with the ingredients and with what it means when you talk about like regional Pakistani food and when you talk about Pakistani food in general, because it's all really fluid and there's so many variables, like any sort of old cuisines, and it all depends on who you're talking to, whose family you're talking to, which dining table you're sitting at.
But were you not cooking when you were growing up? I mean,
I was cooking, but mm-hmm. I was cooking like British food.
Oh,
I was cooking like British food. I was baking. There was a couple of things thrown in there for like, you know, good
even
measure.
Even though you ate more traditional Pakistani food at home?
Yeah. I mean, my mom, I definitely grew up eating Pakistani food, but my mom definitely cooked, you know, European food and what we say in Urdu is like vileti khana, like food that's basically not Pakistani or like South Asian or from the subcontinent. But I never was really, I was so focused on like food nutrition and like what I was learning in school that I wasn't really looking around me, mm-hmm. which I almost regret because I wish that like while I was living at home, I could have been learning all of these things from my family and like being in Pakistan.
Was that a conscious choice? Do you think?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think so. I think I was just really focused on doing really well in this one class and like reading the recipe books that were around me that were not Pakistani and absorbing that and not really trying to understand like how my mom made this like super traditional Pakistani dish. It just wasn't, I think I almost took advantage of it.
It was too close.
Maybe. I wasn't interested in how we make the goat so tender. Mm. I wasn't interested in why this stew tastes different than the one my aunt makes in the south of Pakistan. Like, why is I was just not interested. And now that's sometimes, like, the first thing I think of when I think about, like, what is Pakistani to me and what is, like, Pakistani food. It's all of those, like, variables that I'm still trying to figure out.
I mean, I just wonder if that just plays into, like, the general sort of way food is presented, like how, you know, in order to be like a high-end restaurant or considered like more haute cuisine,
right.
It's always Western food. Like it's always European food. It's always French food. It's always Italian food.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's an expectation you go out to eat at a fancy restaurant, it's going to be, you know, that style of food. And only now, I think, are there more Mexican restaurants and Middle Eastern restaurants that, are kind of changing that conversation. And I wonder if you, and just because of like the type of school that you went to or just the way food was presented to you, that you absorbed that sort of just thought system about, you know, the kind of food that you were interested in and what you wanted to go study.
I think when you look at studying food professionally, you're looking at Europe, you're looking at French training, you're looking at Italian, you're looking at the Mediterranean. It's kind of where cuisine comes from. And so even when I was in school in Lahore, we were doing European food. That was like British food. It was dictated by what, you know, the British education system had kind of wanted us to be learning. And that was kind of what you were tested on also.
Yeah.
And so there wasn't a ton of room for making chapli kebabs, which are super regional to the north of Pakistan. It just wasn't a thing. And it's almost, you know, now that I'm talking about it, I think about it, I'm like, it's almost kind of tragic that we weren't spending more time on just learning what was available to us right there. Because now I go back and I'm like, wow, like this is, like, how do they even make? I was joking with my mom. I was home just last month about how I want to work at, like, the local barbecue joint. Mm-hmm. And she was like, are you crazy? Like, why would you want to go work there? I'm like, because how do they make these, like, perfect kebabs? And how is their chicken so tender? And how do they make sure the chicken just doesn't fall off the skewer? Like, it's all, like, skill and technique that you take advantage of and you don't realize.
And it's also what's available and what's, you know, indigenous to the region and what's seasonal and all those things matter.
Yeah, totally. And so every time I go back, I'm always trying to like take a picture. I'm always trying to absorb as much as I can. I'm always eating out and talking to people because now food, like I said before, is trending. It's trendy. And even in Pakistan. So people even in Pakistan are talking about food, which they do all the time anyway. But now people are really interested on like the perfect lentils, and now people are interested in like why this is different and like what is like native to the north, and you know, which is a place that a lot of people don't visit, and why is it different, and oh, is it influenced by China, like how interesting, like all of these things are now part of the conversation.
And there's pride involved too. Yeah. I mean, it's nice that with the interest comes like a self-ownership and
absolutely
like an acknowledgement that the food that we've been cooking ourselves is, there's a lot of skill behind it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But you were talking before about like restaurants and cuisines in restaurants and how they've always been European, and it's only been in like the past kind of like decade and generation where more like street food is like entering into restaurants. I think that's amazing. Mm-hmm. Like there's not a lot of super high-end Indian restaurants even in the US, you know? There's now a sort of an attempt happening at it. There's an attempt that's going on, but I mean, when people always ask me like where is the best Pakistani place to go eat? Like I make some suggestions, but with hesitations and with disclaimers of this is not exactly what you would eat at like...
Yeah, like my house.
At my house. Yeah. Exactly, right? Or like my sister's house.
Yeah.
Or like wait until my mom visits, you know? And then you'll have a feast. And so it's just interesting how like things are changing. Things are definitely changing. And there's room for that Pakistani restaurant. And there's room for, you know, the cookbooks that we were talking about before that are Pakistani. Because subcontinent cooking, like cooking from that area is definitely, it's always been there and people have been interested. I think there's just more room for like other voices now, and there's people who are looking in that direction or like looking for an education even from like what is the food from there, and how are Pakistani and Indian cuisine different from each other? That's a question I get all the time.
Yeah. We talked about that on the last episode.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's take a quick break here from our commercial and then keep talking.
Sure.
Today's program was brought to you by Roth Cheese, a pioneer in the U.S. specialty cheese movement. Roth is in its 25th year of making specialty cheese in the rolling hills of southern Wisconsin. With strong Swiss heritage, Roth is best known for its award-winning Alpine-style cheeses under the name Grand Cru. Fresh Wisconsin milk, combined with expertise in affinage, is how Roth creates high-quality, great-tasting cheese year after year. In 2016, hard work paid off when out of over 2,000 contenders, Roth Grand Cru Sirchois was named world champion at the World Cheese Championship. For more information, visit rothcheese.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Jenna Liut, and I'm the host of Eating Matters here on HRN. Join me as I talk to food systems experts about the issues that shape our experiences of buying, cooking, and eating food. You can find Eating Matters wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, you're listening to heritageradionetwork.org. This is Food Without Borders. I am your host, Sarah Kamen, and we've been talking to our guest today, Fatima Khawaja. Welcome back.
Thank you.
I just want to read something that you actually wrote me when we started emailing about you coming on the show, if that's okay.
Sure.
Just to kind of switch gears a little bit. You wrote, "When Muslims were targeted during the ban, it felt like for the first time that I didn't belong in the U.S., that my American-born Pakistani fiancé will never understand me, and that I will forever be separated from my family who still lives in Pakistan, or that I will have to return to my city of Lahore and give up everything that I have built here." Do you still feel like that?
I think less. I mean, A, because there's no, like, legit Muslim ban.
Right.
But when that was first being floated around and when that was, like, first happening, it was so jarring.
Yeah.
And it was so, like, even thinking about it now is just, like, so overwhelming to think about that that could be something that's possible. And, you know, just waiting for Pakistan to get on that list and waiting for all of these restrictions to come up and for life to just get harder, it was really hard to wrap your head around that. And I feel like I feel that way less now because some time has passed and because we've gotten to see what politics are coming out of the U.S. And so when you put the Muslim ban in perspective to that, you're like, oh, that was just like another blimp.
It was a day in the news. It was like a headline.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
To put it very
every
nicely.
Every day is a fresh hell.
Yeah, exactly. And so you kind of see that, and then you're kind of like, you can take a deep breath and be like, there are people who are fighting for it. There are people whose voices will be heard. There are people who don't agree with this. Like, this is happening, but it doesn't need to be like the end of the story, you know? And so I feel like talking about it and staying up to date about it and seeing other people's reactions, seeing other minority groups, helps you wrap your head around it.
Like, function. I mean, yeah. Really.
It was
paralyzing. I mean, I'm not going to pretend like it, you know, impacted me in the same way it impacted you, but it was a paralyzing feeling. It was visceral.
I mean, it was a paralyzing fear.
Yeah.
Because I have some family members who, are not citizens who have their green card. I have family members who don't even have green cards and come and go on visas. And so for it to all of a sudden, for this ban to be put on, it's almost as if you're just separating us, you know, families being ripped apart, which is kind of scary that I'm saying that because that has happened to more than just one ethnicity and more than just Muslims. And so I think that it was important then to also just talk about it and to voice your fears and to kind of do the best that you can. I mean, I didn't, like, I remember talking to my sister about it, and I remember talking to my fiance about it, and it's just a really interesting to see, like, all the different perspectives on something like this also, because my fiance at the time, now husband, he was born and raised in the U.S., and so he was born an American, and his parents have been living in the U.S. for, you know, 35 plus years, and my parents are in Pakistan, and so it was really interesting to just, and my sister-in-law works in politics, and so it was really, really interesting and educational and important to talk about these things and to kind of share your views and share what you're feeling and have it all out, because at the end of the day, you're not alone, and whatever might happen, you won't be by yourself, and it's really important, because, you know, when Trump was elected, I was in restaurants, and I think that was a really good time to be in restaurants, because it reminds you of the fact that you're not alone, you're not the only Muslim, you're not the only brown girl, you're not the only person of color, you're not the only, like, young immigrant trying to make something, like, you know, there's times where I've been in kitchens where there's no, like, Native American, like, someone from America, right. everyone's an immigrant,
yeah,
and you're just kind of like, this is like a beacon of, this is America,
yeah,
and so that's, like, a really, really good feeling, yeah. when you speak to people and they have accents, and you speak to people and, you know, they're still trying to figure out their immigration status, and you speak to people who just came here for a different kind of life for themselves, whether that be better or worse, and I think that that's really, really important to kind of go through something like the Muslim ban.
Yeah, and it sounds like, I mean, from what you wrote to me after that, that you, it kind of pushed you to sort of embrace your Pakistani identity even more.
Right.
Because, you know, we can hear you. You don't necessarily sound like you're someone from Pakistan.
Right.
You don't necessarily even look like you're someone from Pakistan. So it sort of pushed you to kind of claim that identity in a more present way.
Absolutely. I think that I never really shied away from being Pakistani. I think there were times where I was like, it doesn't need to be shouted from the rooftops, really, that I'm from Pakistan. But I was never, like, people ask me where I'm from, and unless you're someone who's, like, badgering me, you know, who's being like, so where are you from? And they're trying to make conversation, like, outside, you know, on the street. I will always really proudly be like, I'm from Pakistan. Also because it's a conversation starter. And then also just to break the stereotype. I think it's really, really important to present different faces. Different faces of Pakistan and where you're from. And I was just telling my husband before I came here, I was in Pakistan and they thought I was a foreigner there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they asked me, they're like, are you a foreigner? I'm like, no. They're like, are you sure? I'm like, I'm positive. I mean, do you want to see my ID? And they're like, no, like, it's fine. Like, you can be on your way. Like, what is that? It's really funny. But I think that through all of this, it made me stronger and more proud, and it's kind of created its own kind of community of, like, immigrants and people who want to fight for basic rights and who want to band together, and this industry is the industry for that.
Yeah, that's a good kind of band.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I just want to close out and read one more thing that you wrote me, because I just loved it. When you were talking about Pakistan, you said, you know, just trying to change people's perceptions or just explain where you come from. You said, we are a country filled with love, kindness, hospitality, and rice, as far as the eye can see, and so much more.
Yeah.
And you said in the commercial break that, you know, maybe you were going to open, like, the first high-end Pakistani restaurant in New York. And I just think that's a great idea.
That would be a feat in itself. I can't wait for like the Pakistani to show up at the door and be like, you're doing it wrong. Like, that's what would happen.
Well, right. We were just saying how, you know, it's really just started to happen with Indian cuisine.
Right.
But it hasn't quite made its way yet to Pakistani. And I think it will.
One day.
Yeah.
I can see it. I mean, it was really exciting what we were talking about before about your previous host and your previous guest.
And
Gosser, and about her cookbook. Like, Pakistani cookbooks is a novelty. Like, that's not that common. And so when you start to see things like that, you're like, we need all we can get. We need the good publicity.
Yeah, well, I think it speaks to that curiosity that people, you know, they're interested in street food and they want to start figuring out, you know, where can I go to a restaurant and eat food like that?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Totally.
And you're the perfect kind of emissary for that.
Right.
Possibly.
I try.
Well, tell us where we can, you know, keep up with what you're working on and follow you on social media.
So I do want to start working on a website since I've been freelancing and I'm on my own. But I did start an Instagram. It's Fati Eats, F-A-T-I. Eats, E-A-T-S, which is just kind of a play on the play on words. And I just post mostly food that I make, whether that be for myself or whether that be for clients or events. And I'm just trying to grow.
If we wanted to hire you to cater an event?
Well, you can reach me there on Instagram. I think I have my email up. I also created a Facebook page by the same name. So you can definitely reach out to me there. And more to come.
Yeah, great. Well, Fatima, thank you so much
for coming
on the show.
Thank you so much.
It was, you know, fabulous to talk to you, and I wish we could just keep talking, and I'm sure we will. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in. Find us again next week on heritageradionetwork.org, Wednesdays at 6 p.m. ET, and check us out on iTunes and Stitcher and Spotify.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right-hand side of our homepage. Thanks for listening.